Good morning. Open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. It's good to have Senator George back with us. He's been battling an ear.
Inner ear virus is what they say, so you're totally out of balance. So voice is still a little effect of the nausea, but I'm here.
Boy, that sounds, inner ear virus sounds.
Dizzy Dean.
Dizzy Dean. Well, it's good to have you back.
I know we have politicians that are out of balance.
That's true. We're off to a good start already on Monday. So we have bills. We have the larger, the bonding bills. And so we're going to set up an overview first. We're going to open a public hearing on them and do an overview of debt issues facing Oregon with our debt experts. And then we'll move on to the community colleges and higher ed and hear testimony about exactly what is in the bills. With that, I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5516 and Senate Bill 152. Mazin, I don't know if we need an introduction.
I don't have much of an introduction, Mr. Chair. I don't have nothing. Nobody has been telling me nothing.
Well, that's a good introduction to our...
His inner ear is bothering him, too.
It's all uphill from here.
You don't have that option. Yeah. So introduce Laura Lockwood McCall and Mr. Kinney from DAS and hand it over to you guys to walk us through what I think is the most germane question for this committee is proper debt levels for the state.
Thank you, Chair Deckert. Laura Lockwood McCall, Office of State Treasurer. I'm the Director of the Debt Management Division. What I'm going to show you this morning in about 10 minutes is a summary of a report that was produced fairly recently by the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. That's a group that's composed of the treasurer as the chair. There's a representative from the House Representatives, Tom Butler. Senator Metzger represents the Senate, and then we have a public member as well as the director of DAS. So this is a report that was released March 1st, and I'm just going to give you the high-level summary of the findings. Purpose of this report, which is done annually, is to provide a framework to measure, monitor, and manage the state's overall debt levels. This will give us an analytical approach so that we each year can go back and say, where are we and where will we be over time with our debt? And finally, it's to provide information to the legislature to formulate long-term capital spending plans going forward. Briefly, I want to give you a few debt capacity concepts. I apologize if you've heard this before in some of the other presentations I did at Ways and Means. But there are four major categories of bonds that we look at. The first is general obligation bonds. These all require voter approval under the state constitution that does pledge the full faith and credit. And in some of our general obligation bonds are general fund supported, similar to the bonds you'll be hearing about today that are the 11G bonds. The many other GO bonds the state issues are self-supporting, including higher education's 11F bonds, which have revenues that cover the debt service. But ultimately, if those revenues aren't available, the general fund would obviously be on the hook. We also issue general obligation bonds for veterans loans, for energy loans, for DEQ loans, and many other programs around the state. Direct revenue bonds are just that. Only the revenues of a specific state agency are pledged to the repayment. There is no general fund pledge by the state. These are generally created under statute, and we make sure that they're all fully self-supporting in each of the various borrowings to get the best interest rate and to protect the state's overall name and reputation in the credit markets. We have appropriation credits that are not general obligation bonds and not direct revenue bonds. Two that come to mind are the big certificate of participation program the state has engaged in over the last 15, 20 years that finance things like state office buildings, state prisons, equipment, which are lease financing arrangements. And finally, we have appropriation bonds, which was a one-time deficit financing that was done in 2003 to help the state bridge a gap in its budget. They're not secured by full faith and credit, and they have a lower credit rating, and therefore, obviously, a slightly higher interest cost than the other types of bonds I've described. Finally, we have a number of state agencies that issue conduit revenue bonds. There's no state credit. There's no state pledge of repayment. However, we do offer under federal tax law and then through state law the ability of certain governmental purpose conduits to finance, use the state of Oregon on their name, and to get the benefit of those tax-exempt interest rates. This is a snapshot of the last 20 years of the state's overall debt levels. Blue shows you the general obligation bonds, the direct revenue bonds are in red, and the appropriation credits are in yellow. You'll note that overall debt was going down from about 1986 through roughly 2000. Overall levels were dropping primarily because veteran loan programs were dropping. Mm-hmm. While there was an increasing amount of direct revenue bonds during that same period, and we were beginning to use COPs to finance prisons primarily, the change in the direction really started accelerating with the recession of the early 2000s. We'll be talking about the appropriation deficit bonds and also the pension obligation bonds, but that combination plus the increasing use of direct revenue bonds primarily to finance transportation projects through ODOT is what's leading to this growth that you see in the last few years. This is just the general obligation portion, so you can sort of see the purple is what's been dropping. That was the veterans loans. And a small but growing portion of other general obligation bonds, primarily for higher education. And the yellow shows you 2003, 2004, when the pension obligation bonds were issued. I won't go into too much depth about that other than to suggest that they were sold at an all-in interest rate of approximately 5.8%, which was a reduction in the liability the state would have faced in terms of its unfunded liability with PERS, which was about 8%. So while we did incur debt, we did it for good reasons. We chose to lower our overall costs. It was just moving the debt from one side of our balance sheet to the debt side of our balance sheet. So when you see some of the debt ratios, we do them with and without those pension obligation bonds. A recent report, in fact, from Standard & Poor's shows that when you take our tax-supported debt and our unfunded liability, which is actually overfunded at the moment, collectively, we have one of the lowest overall debt per capita in the United States. Other states have not necessarily chosen to finance their unfunded liabilities with debt. And so this is the first report that I've seen, came out recently, that shows apples-to-apples comparisons. And so when you add the two together, we're still in relatively good shape compared to most states in the country.
So what are most other states?
The median right now is in the neighborhood. And they use per capita personal income. I want to say it's around 4 to 5%. Let's just peg it at 5. I don't have the paperwork with me. Ours was at 2.9% of personal income. And so it's a combination of where you stand with your pension system and the debt, and the tax-supported debt you have outstanding. We can provide you a copy of the report if you'd like.
But so it's your position. We've been relatively conservative in terms of...
Well, this is true. But I think also the fact that we have an overfunded pension system at the moment is what's really helping us. We borrowed at just the right moment because the stock market has been quite favorable for the last few years. We also undertook significant pension reform to make sure that on an ongoing basis we wouldn't have big unfunded liabilities. So the combination of those two events all struck at the right moment. So our net tax-supported debt, if you just look at it by itself, is above the median. But when you add to it the current position of PERS, that's the combination that puts us ahead of other states who may not have issued pension obligation bonds but have large unfunded liabilities. This shows you the direct revenue bonds. And you can see the blue started growing. That's our single and multifamily mortgage programs. Now, we're issuing at a higher level than we were in the 90s, but having taken a look at sort of the number of loans that are being issued, they're not really growing. It's just that the cost of construction has increased substantially since the 90s, and so what you're seeing is it's the average size of those loans are growing to kind of match where the housing markets are. Lottery bonds is something that we've started using in the 90s, and you can see that that has grown significantly in the last several years. As I mentioned, ODOT programs, which is in yellow, that will be a continuing growth area for us. We have $1.2 billion, give or take, left to issue under OTIA 3 programs. And then finally, we have a small bond bank program for local governments' wastewater programs, which is a light blue. Appropriation bonds.
I think we have a couple questions.
Excuse me,
slide.
Sure.
Senator George.
back to the ODOT bonds. The last time I asked, we were at $1.836 billion left on OTM.
I believe we issued bonds last year about $400 million, so 1.8.
Mm-hmm.
I will go back and double check for you. We have a little piece left for the OTA 1 and 2, and we have a chunk left for OTA 3. I'll make a note to get back to you.
One other question on the lottery bonds. And I'll let you make that note before asking for another note.
Sure.
So on the lottery bonds, I think if you asked around here, there would be general concern about, and maybe it's just folks have been around for this period where that red bar grew from very small to relatively large or much bigger. Is concerned that we're eating up lottery revenues and dedicate, and what we don't eat up in bonding, we dedicate for reserve fund or parks through initiative. Is that a concern that you have when you look at the lottery bonding, and then where the sustainability of that revenue source, can it continue to grow like it has through the 90s?
To Senator Deckard, if I can ask you to hold your question, I have a couple of slides, slides ahead in the presentation that look at lottery debt capacity specifically.
Great.
If that would be okay.
That'd be great.
To get to there. Because that's one of the two areas that we forecast, and we can talk about sort of where we are and where we may be headed.
Perfect.
Okay. So, quickly, so I can get to that slide, the appropriation credits. You can see the blue is the certificates of participation. The number starts, or the bar starts jumping pretty substantially in the late 90s as the state began major construction of various correctional facilities. And then the appropriation deficit bonds are the purple. Those will be paid off in full in 2014. While we didn't pledge tobacco settlement funds, that is the backfill to the general fund that repays that particular type of debt. We issued $452 million, I believe, when we did it initially, and I think we still have somewhere in the neighborhood of $330, don't quote me exactly, in the balance. But those will be paid off fairly rapidly in the next several years. There are a number of constitutional and statutory provisions that limit debt in the state, but as you can see, and this is just a sampler, the ones in the state constitution generally are based on real market value, and they're fairly high. So state highways, for example, has a 1% cap, but that would represent $5 billion. That's not terribly realistic if we want to manage our debt and our revenue streams carefully. Similarly for higher ed, and you can see that while we have a cap right now of $2.7 billion, as of the end of the fiscal year, we had $196 million of actual 11G debt. The point of the Debt Capacity Commission is to look more realistically at the real revenues of the state, both lottery revenues and general fund, and then to come up with more realistic and prudent limits that we should base our budgeting on and our long-term capital planning on.
And this is a dumb question, but 11G, and is that just the section of state statute?
Yes, it is. We sort of use it as shorthand. It's Article 11, Section G, which is the part where higher education can issue bonds if there's a 50% match that comes from outside of the state. General obligation bonds. 11F is the self-supporting. 11J is for energy, and I don't know all the other ones off the top of my head, but that's...
So that's your shorthand of, if you do 11J, you're doing an energy bonding project.
Exactly, and you'll be hearing about 11G and 11F today.
Another question on that. Do you know, is there any other, since we're looking at higher ed-related ones right now, that require that private match?
Well...
At 50% or
I know there's a number of folks who are talking about different ways to do the Article 11, Section M and N, which is the seismic safety programs. I don't know what the final policy decision will be, but I've at least heard folks talk about possibly making that a match program. I also know there's a HJR 13 bill before the legislature this session, which would be a 50% match for local school districts to state GO bonds.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any others that you're aware of that are currently in law?
Not to my knowledge.
So at this point, it's mostly higher ed related that have the 50% private match.
Or whatever source. And I believe community college also is part of that 11G, so they've been using that as well.
Mm-hmm.
You see some of the statutes that authorize lottery bonds, highway bonds, et cetera. So let's get to the meat of the matter, which is the forecast of both the general fund and lottery back debt. Again, our recommended target, the commission's target for a number of years, has been the general fund supported debt service, which is principal plus interest, should not exceed more than 5% of general fund revenues for any given fiscal year. As of 6/30/06, we were at 3.7%. I'll show you some slides as to where those trends have been going over the last few years. Lottery back debt is based on a legal bond covenant, which says that lottery revenue must be at least four times the amount of debt service on those bonds. We were the first state in the country to do lottery bonded debt bonds, and so we chose a very conservative coverage factor. State of Florida, which is one of the other issuers, does it at three times. So to kind of get to your question as to do we have too much or do we have too little, we've chosen a fairly conservative coverage. The rating agencies most recently took a look at our lottery bonds, and we were rated AAA by Standard & Poor's, and we were upgraded to AA3 by Moody's. Fitch still sees this as sort of a challenging revenue stream. They don't trust it, if you will, in the same way, because it is gambling, and on some level, so we're in the A-plus category with Fitch. So you now have three different rating agencies in three different rating categories looking at our lottery revenue, which helps explain why I was trying to dance around your question, because I think it all depends on how you look at that, depending on your methodology and your thinking. But what you can see is, as of 6/30/06, our lottery debt coverage was 7.4 times the amount of debt service that we had outstanding. So while we've issued a lot of debt for lottery bonds, the revenues have grown faster. And I'll show you some slides to just show you that.
And maybe I'm just getting to those slides, and that's fine. If Fitch's was here, would they say, we would prefer Oregon, if being objective to this, to not be issuing lottery bonds because we're concerned about that source of revenue?
No, they would never tell you they wouldn't want you to do something. What they would just suggest to the investor is that it's a bit riskier than other types of revenue streams. Whereas S&P took a look at both our ODOT debt and raised us to AAA because they have a very different methodology. They say, look at this gas tax. This is a dedicated revenue stream. You can't use it for health care. You can't use it for education. It's just for ODOT. And similarly, they looked at the lottery. And what they noticed was that good times are bad, recessions are good times, the amount of lottery revenue just kept going straight up. Mm-hmm. So they have just a very different, very sort of economic-only view. So they made that decision. Moody's upgraded us because our coverage was so strong. Mm-hmm. We weren't anywhere near four times. We're at 7.4 now. But there's still some concern that we're a state that has a low threshold for initiatives. Things could change. The lottery could change. People could move on to different activities. Fitch is just more concerned that that could occur. And they emphasize that more in their ratings to investors than does the other two firms. But it is one of the only credits I've ever worked on that has three ratings. So there is not a unanimity of thinking on Wall Street as to our bonds in this area. I'm not going to have time today to go over net tax-supported debt, non-tax-supported debt, but those are other categories that we do keep track of as well. So these are all the different kinds of bonds that are subject that we call general fund supported debt. You'll see the higher ed and community college Section 11G bonds. Pollution control bonds, we count 85% of the total because we roughly think that general fund supports about 85% of the cost. If we had any outstanding water resource bonds, those would count, which we've paid them off in full currently. OHSU, we sold $200 million a few years back for their programs. If we get a seismic retrofit programs going, those will be considered general fund supported. And finally, a portion of the pension obligation bonds that were issued in 2003, we estimate that roughly 38% of payroll comes out of the general fund to pay the debt service, with the balance coming from other funds. And then the appropriation credits that I've mentioned. So as of the end of the calendar year, we had $2.6 billion in outstanding general fund supported debt. This is, I think, a nice high-level summary of where we've been over the last 8 or 9 years. It shows you, the purple bar shows you the overall amount of debt. But then we look at the target goal, which is the debt service as a percentage of general fund revenues. Clearly, that started rising. If you look at the scale to the right, we were under 2% for most of the late 90s, early 2000s. It jumped up to 3% in 2003, once we issue the appropriation deficit bonds, and then the pension bonds in shows up in 2004 fiscal year. But we stayed level, even though the amount of debt has gone has grown. And what that tells me is that general fund revenues have grown at a fast enough pace that we seem to hit, at least at this point, some steady state. And this forecast for 2007 shows that we'll continue to increase that general fund supported debt. But we have been doing it at a level and in a fashion where we're keeping our budget in line with our debt service. So that's the first step.
Can I ask you about the last bar? So the last bar on there, is that assuming that we approve the governor's budget in 2007?
No, that's 2007. So that's the budget, the debt that was approved by the 2005 legislature, what we will issue between now and the end of the fiscal year. So going forward, I'm about to show you a slide about how much capacity we would have for the upcoming next 2 years as you go about your deliberations for the governor's budget and your own desires for the bond bill.
Great.
Okay. Again, this just shows you the math calculation that we use. And our goal was just to keep it below 5%. As we have a model that puts all this information in there, and just so you know, we've incorporated the December 2006 revenue forecast. There wasn't much of an appreciable difference for March, and we published by March 1st, so we weren't able to include that. We assume 20-year debt. The long-term interest rate over the last several years has been 4.59%. So this is the forecast. The 2007, as I said, assumed that we issued the balance of bonds that were authorized by the previous legislature. And on a going forward basis, the model simply says what would be the maximum amount of additional debt that could be issued at these various assumptions in keeping the level of debt below 5%. So we forecast out for 6 years, and we just do the math, and that totals over that six-year period $2.367 billion. Now, we don't recommend that all of that could be issued. General fund revenues could drop. Things could change. So we basically divide by six and say, let's be prudent about it and you know, take 2 years at a slot. So in our base case of the $2.3 billion, that would forecast a maximum, if you wanted to stay at or below 5%, of $789 million. We looked at what if interest rates go up and over the next few years, how much would that eat into this six-year capacity? It would drop it by a couple hundred million, so that would drop the per biennium forecast by approximately $64 million. We also looked at changes in general fund revenue based on some comments that I heard at an earlier Ways and Means presentation just to start doing sensitivity analysis around that. So a 10% decline in revenues, which we had a 10% increase in revenues this past couple of years, could occur the other way. And you can see that that would have a fairly dramatic effect on how much debt should be issued per biennium. So this just starts giving us a flavor of kind of orders of magnitude in terms of what gets authorized in the future. Added up what's in the governor's budget proposal that would be considered general fund, and Jack will be talking about this a little bit more in depth, but it was $711 million.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Monroe.
Last week, we created a rainy day fund. One of the arguments for doing that was that it would improve our bond rating. Have you figured that into any of your calculations?
Senator Deckert, Senator Monroe, I used our long-term average interest rate. So I didn't help or hurt it, because you have to pick an interest rate. And while the credit rating will help us if we get an upgrade in terms of going into the market, we're also influenced by the overall market. And so the larger issue is where will long-term interest rates be, and then how we benefit above or below maybe some median average, I think will help us on the margins. But in the absence of knowing specifically where interest rates will be, we just choose a long-term average.
And by long-term, I mean, I kind of had the same question. So by long-term, you look at
5 years. I've gone 5 years in terms of, and interest rates have been fairly low for the last 5 years. And but we just have weekly indices, and we just say, okay, what has that weekly index been for a 20-year bond for the last 5 years? Which is why we started trying to say, okay, if interest rates are one full percentage point higher or one full percentage point lower, in the long run, where will we be? Because that has the strongest impact on our interest rates. Even, I hate to say it, even more than just our credit rating. So,
well, you can say it now, we're done.
Well, it's kind of like mortgages. You might have a better or worse credit rating, and you might get a little bit of a benefit or hurt by your credit score, but all people going to get home mortgages are mostly influenced by where the overall markets are.
Right, the market. So it's a is it fair to say, on Senator Moreau's question, we can feel at least more solid in that $789 million figure, because, I mean, we're, as you know, the decisions we're trying to make, and when we consider these two bills, is how much, and so we look at that 789, and I guess the second part of that question is, how often do we come, do we march right up to the level, if you put 789 down, how often do we march right up to that level here, or should we?
Well, I think, again, we haven't been anywhere near the 5%, although we did start growing towards it, but we're nowhere near it. And that's why we started trying to say, okay, well, what could be the things that could hurt us if we want to keep it below 5%? Obviously, if you do half of 789, you're not going to get up to the 5%. But this was a six-year forecast, and we tried to not use all of our capacity. We do it every year. We take new revenue forecasts, and so there's a self-correction mechanism just built in. And, of course, we don't issue all 789 even at the beginning of a biennium. If there really was a huge drop-off in revenue, that would be something I know the state treasurer's office would want to come back to the legislature and double-check that if revenue's dropped off, it wouldn't necessarily make sense to continue to sell all the bonds even in a biennium, without making sure that there really was debt serviceability to repay. Mm-hmm. So I feel comfortable that the 789, if that's what you're looking for, that methodologically it's a solid a number as we can get, because our entire method of forecasting can constantly be modified and updated for corrections.
Somewhere else. Just to kind of summarize my understanding, if long-term interest rates bump up a small amount and our bond rating is improved because of the action taken last week, we might end up flat.
Sure.
And if interest rates actually stay the same as they are now, the action we took last week would actually cause our bonding capacity to increase because the interest rate would drop some.
Slightly, yes. The answer would be yes.
Thank you.
But it's a very dynamic market, so none of these things happen in isolation to each other. So I want to be careful that I can't guarantee this for you. So, but yes, in general, that would be the theory.
I must never guarantee anything.
Try not to.
And is it helpful for us to stay below that 5%? I mean, perhaps it's just a comfort level to when you showed me showed us the slide 3 back with the bars. There's a comfort level knowing that we are below. And so I guess any discomfort that when we look at these bills or others is, you wrap, obviously, if you had a 09, 011, or you would, and even an 07, 09.
You would bump up and you would stay up.
That's what I would assume. I'm trying to picture what your graph looks like for.
If you were to issue 789 for the next three bienniums, we would bump up to the blue line would go to the top, and of course the red line would continue to grow. But the idea would be is we would bump up and stay there. So, because it's, we're paying debt off even as we're issuing debt. So, just adding up the next two-year forecast would be 849. So we wouldn't quite hit the 5% because we're just averaging out individual years across a six-year horizon. So we'd still be a little bit below 5%. I think it's a comfort level. I think the legislature needs to balance out trying to be fiscally prudent, which is very important, but also making the right investments. And not to be so fiscally prudent that we don't invest in the things that in the long run the state needs to be successful and for the citizenry to thrive. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you do those things and you invest those capital dollars properly, then you're going to get the revenue growth that you wanted in the first place. Mm-hmm. That will help pay off the debt and help the citizenry survive and thrive. So that's the balancing act, is to neither be too tight or too pushy on the opposite side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's the challenge of finding the right level. And so, again, I'm trying to kind of make you feel comfortable that 5% is reasonable. It's a reasonable level to go to from an investment in the future perspective.
And I know Mr. Kinney's going to get into this, but I guess that's the $64,000 question, is you feel we have, this is the sweet spot in terms of the bills and the package that the governor has put forth, really is that sweet spot, and I don't want to, we want the treasurer's office.
I can't speak on behalf of the treasurer, but I do believe that he supported the bond bill and the budget and agreed to the recommended levels that were proposed. We are not involved in the specifics of those projects, however, so we're trying to give you a framework that you can make prioritization and balancing decisions against. Continuing on to lottery bonds, we've done 19 sales of lottery bonds to date. Outstanding indebtedness was $577 million as of the end of the calendar year, but we recently just sold a fairly large $200+ million sale of lottery bonds that were approved by the legislature this past 2 years ago, including the balance for Connect Oregon and a number of other projects. And you can see the sort of the laundry list of different types of projects that are available and have been issued for the program. A similar graph to the one you saw before, which looks at, again, the purple shows you where lottery bond total outstanding indebtedness has been, and then the coverage levels, which is our way of managing the amount of debt service and our forecast methodology. What you'll see is that we had huge amounts of lottery capacity back in 99, and as the program has grown and we've started to use it more often, that coverage level has dropped. But in no case have we gotten down to 4, which is roughly where the black line is, the bottom one. And we will end the year, actually, the fiscal year, at roughly 9 times coverage, which might explain why we have seen improved credit ratings. The lottery revenue, obviously, has just grown by leaps and bounds with the introduction of video slots. And so although we've had a fairly ambitious lottery issuance approach, the revenues grew to meet it. Now, if we had not introduced video slots, I'd have a very different story to show you and a much lower coverage to show you. And indeed, I thought 2 years ago when the lottery bond package was approved that that would be pretty much all we could do other than a fairly small increase in the future. So the growth in that lottery revenue has had a huge impact in terms of why you're seeing even more proposals to use lottery bonds. But as you can see, our trend has been anything but down. It's been upward, which I hope answers some of the questions you had a little earlier. Now, granted that we're tying up more and more revenue with lottery bonds, but it seems to be, on a percentage basis, my guess is that it's a smaller percentage of total lottery revenues than it has been. Perhaps Mason could tell me whether that's true, but we can give you the underlying debt service schedules. But if our coverage is going up, that tells you that there's more revenues. Again, we use a similar forecast methodology, the December 06 forecast. We use the same interest rate, the same term. And this is the forecast.
Ask you a question, and it's 2 slides back, and now forget. you had mentioned Florida as being particularly aggressive in terms of its lottery bonding program, and Oregon being one of the first states in. And I know it's hard to rank states, but where would we rank in terms of more aggressive using lottery bonds, less aggressive than most states?
Well, collectively we're more aggressive because only Florida, Oregon, and West Virginia have even sold lottery bonds. Many, many states have lottery programs, but only a few have chosen to actually bond against it. So since we were the first, we chose a conservative coverage because we wanted to get a good credit rating and have investors interested. Florida came in later, and they're 3 times coverage. But when we got upgraded, they got upgraded as well, by S&P at least. So among all the states, the fact that we're doing it at all, the 2 states are kind of on the outer edge. But it's considered a good investment. I mean, lots of people are interested and call us on the phone when they want to buy lottery bonds in the state. So it's a good credit. We've been paying our debt, and it's a well-performing investment.
So I guess if you're sitting up here, the natural question is, if there's only 3 states that are doing it, and 47, some I assume don't have lottery, but most do, they've elected not to, I think it just it leads to some skepticism as a good bonding source, because so many states have projects they'd like to obviously bond for and have decided that is not a good revenue source to bond against.
I don't know much more about how other states have gone through the thinking about that, truthfully. I was not familiar with it until I came here. But I would suggest that the fact that we have high credit ratings might indicate that perhaps it's an untapped source that other states just haven't looked into. Because it's worked real well for here, and I've learned to appreciate it quite a bit in the last couple of years as a funding source. Other states have completely different revenue structures. They have sales taxes. They have mm-hmm. other types of financing techniques.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the only person that might the only folks that might argue are folks that would be the recipients of the lottery revenue that is not going into the bonding that would otherwise receive lottery revenue.
Sure.
That's always the...
That's the trade-off.
The trade-off that you have.
Things are done differently.
That's right. That's our motto. Or that will be our motto.
So this is a slightly different approach, but what you see going forward is that we use that 4x coverage. Well, there's a huge pop in the first year because you get to use up all that revenue you don't have, and then obviously smaller amounts in future years. So again, we divide it by 6. Give you 2 years' worth of revenue. So the recommendation is, despite the fact there's, you could bond $906 million if you wanted to next fiscal year, but we don't suggest you do that, but rather that we divide it by 6, we get $486 million per biennium. And similar to what I mentioned about general fund supported debt, the lottery revenue bond forecast is very sensitive to both interest rates, but even more so to lottery revenue changes. So if there's a decline in revenue, you see that the amount of capacity drops pretty substantially. Also, if we do more taxable programs, by that I mean public-private partnerships, where there is a fairly significant private component, then we need to issue those bonds on a taxable basis, which is at a much higher interest rate. We are using 1.25%, I believe, as the amount of how much higher that interest rate would be on a taxable basis, and that does eat into capacity. So that's the forecast. The governor's budget, I believe, has $443 million in proposed lottery revenue bonds. I will say I sort of keep track just because I've been asked to kind of do that for the state treasurer of all the other lottery bonds that I know about. I count, right now, besides the 443 in the governor's budget, there's another $427 million floating around mm-hmm. with a couple of question marks for court facilities and transportation projects. So that's in something like 13 or 14 bills that I've noticed.
There are more coming from what I hear, or at least more ideas floating for lottery bonds.
So I am sensitive to your suggestion that we could eat up a lot of lottery capacity, and I think it would be imprudent to go at all higher than the 486 that's recommended, mm-hmm. Particularly because of the sensitivity and the large drop in capacity if, for some reason, lottery use diminishes.
And Mazen, do we have any sense? I know it's starting to, the lottery revenue for the first time is at least starting to show signs of flattening, or not that exponential growth. Do we have any modeling or any evidence from other states that at some point it will not continue? And that's the assumption one would make, is that at some point it will not continue to grow.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the lottery revenue have been surprising us on the upside rather than on the downside. The expectation that the growth will be governed by an upper band of disposable personal income. People cannot, at the end, spend more than they have in disposable personal income. However, the growth that has happened has been phenomenal. However, there are also the risks that you've heard about of the different gambling venues, if you will, that are and the opportunities that are happening. And we have experienced in the past, once the Native American casinos, the tribal casinos started opening, we saw a decline once. Now with the introduction of what is known as the La Center, the mega casino is coming, and other opportunities, that is a risk for the lottery that might sustain the growth even more than we probably think. So there is a risk out there, and the forecast is not to exceed the disposable personal income, about 5.5% growth a year. That's what we think.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Starr.
Again, what you just said, the risk to the lottery, does that contemplate these increased opportunities for other gambling establishments, or does that not?
The 5.5% does not include all the risks, but the risks are out there that will take it to zero or sometimes a little lower growth. We think they will be there, but I think once people have more than one venue of exposing or expending of their disposable income, they would probably diversify their gambling. And therefore, they might not all spend it on gaming on the lottery.
Right. Mr. Chair, isn't there also an initiative that's been filed to allow for a pretty significant private gambling facility somewhere in the Portland metropolitan area?
Yep.
So I think it's prudence is in line here, I think. Mm-hmm. We look forward to borrowing on the lottery revenues.
So, I mean, I know it's impossible to accurately forecast, but if, say, that initiative, and in 4 years we had a major casino in downtown Portland, my gut, non-economist, is you're going to lose 30-40% of your lottery revenue. That may be...
I'm not in a position to answer. I can tell you that if lottery revenues dropped at that level, we wouldn't be issuing any more lottery bonds for certain. We would hit our coverage. We'd be able to most likely continue to... There is an underlying moral obligation pledge of the state to replenish debt service reserves if, for some reason, we had no revenue. Mm-hmm. But at 4x coverage, we're more conservative, as I said. It would take quite a bit, a drop, at this point, to not be able to cover what we've got. Mm-hmm. But on a going forward basis, again, I think that's perhaps where Fitch is coming from, mm-hmm. Perhaps more than S&P at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, the drop could be significant. Well, but remember that when the time when we saw the drop here in Oregon, the lottery actually went and worked on changing the matrix of payout. So payout was at a certain level. And what they were able to do is push payout more. So if that generated more interest in the game and brought more players back, because after all, gambling, it's still a reward versus risk type of game. And if there's a higher payout in one game, so the lottery was able to adjust in different ways. The matrix of payment, this is the same thing that happened, for example, with Powerball. Powerball, their matrix of payment or winning numbers have been changed or reconfigured enough that the pot of money that needs to be won every time started growing a lot faster, a lot bigger, which attracted more people. So there are ways that we have the lottery able to do in order to maintain some market share regardless of the competition. Now, how much your profit becomes out of that profit as in the state mm-hmm. system. That always is
the question. You,
and also, it is a policy decision. Mm-hmm. Where do we go with this?
I think it's why you have more skepticism around at least the GO portion versus the lottery, given just the immediate risks that one can point to.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Moreau.
A couple of things. I'm followed the proposal for a private casino in the Portland area. All of those proposals would include the government taking a pretty sizable cut of the revenue. So I would assume that would replace losses to the lottery to some degree. But also there's huge political opposition. That proposal is in kind of my area. It's in the Wood Village area. And believe me, the folks are adamant that I've heard from that they don't want it. So I think there's great political difficulties to having a major casino in private or public in the Portland area. But it is a possible caution. The other comment I'd like to make is staff's comment about disposable personal income. I just read an article on the use of payday loans. That a very high percentage of the use of payday loans is people that are chronic gamblers, and they borrow to gamble. So people don't always just gamble with their disposable income. They gamble with tomorrow's income and the interest that they're going to have to pay on it.
On tomorrow's.
A little bit higher than our interest costs.
A little bit.
So my conclusion, if I may, is that at least the debt that we currently have outstanding, the commission found that our debt continues to be managed prudently. We are not entering into any kind of undue risk at this point and trying to get the lowest interest costs and refund whenever we can to continue to drive our interest costs downward. I've told you the maximum amount that the commission felt was okay this coming biennium, and that would be $789 million in general fund supported debt and a maximum of $486 million in lottery bond capacity. And I think you would agree, and the commission would recommend, that while the upturns in state revenue have created this additional capacity, careful prioritization and allocation of debt capacity continues to occur to keep us within the debt ratios and obviously to make sure that we don't get too far over our head with debt if there is a downturn in the economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Laura Lockwood McCall, our expert in the state on these questions. If you could provide, as you did at the beginning, who is on the debt management, but if you just send us to Paul's office, or you have it right there.
And also, I think at this point, each of you should have received one of these reports. If not, I have some extras. Like
I'm sure our office is our report central this time of year. but there it is. Great. Good morning.
Senator Deckard, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Kenny. I'm the finance manager of the Department of Administrative Services. Do you have my handout?
We do.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think with Laura's presentation and your questions, probably a lot of this material has already been covered. My plan will be basically to take the context of debt capacity that Laura has outlined so well and use that framework to talk about the governor's budget and the details that are in that.
Great.
Okay. First page of my handout, I'll just go kind of quickly through that, is a little chart with some boxes on it that talks about the bonding and capital construction budget process. Laura has talked extensively about the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission that's on the side. As agencies prepare their budget, they contemplate what items to include that might be financed, and so I'll just move quickly through that. But it is, in addition to capital construction, there's also capital improvements, equipment, grant and loan funds, and things of that nature that sometimes are funded with the proceeds of bond sales. So I just mentioned that to let you know that there'll be things that'll be in agency budgets that won't necessarily be in a capital construction bill. It might be a computer system or things like that. So through that process, the items that make it through the governor's approval and prioritization process are included in the governor's recommended budget, and you'd see them in several forms. Agency appropriation bills, as I just mentioned, for the equipment, for debt service, for grant programs. The bond bill, Laura mentioned that in her presentation. Those are the two-year limits that the legislature puts on the amount of bonds to issue. Capital construction bills, there's two of them. House Bill 5006 and Senate Bill 5516, which you have before you today. That's for higher ed and community colleges, capital construction items. Those items, the items that are approved in the capital construction bill that you're reviewing today, have six-year limitations as opposed to a typical item in a budget that has a two-year limitation. So an item that's approved in Senate Bill 5516, a project, they'll have 6 years to expend those funds. Just to let you know. And then there's another bond bill that has the lottery bond authorizations. And then I put out bucks on the side for other proposed bills that aren't in the governor's budget, and Laura's mentioned those as well. So all those will be before you and be competing for that limited resource that Laura has mentioned. Just quickly talking about Senate Bill 5516 itself. Again, I think Laura did cover this, so I'll go through it pretty quickly. Article 11G The purpose of it from the Constitution is included in my presentation, construct, improve, repair, equip, and furnish buildings and structures for higher education or for community colleges. And they cannot be used for any buildings or projects that are wholly self-liquidating or self-supporting. That's the 11F bonds that that you and Laura discussed a few minutes ago. So 11G cannot be self-supporting. 11F is the program that's used for that. They are both general obligation bonds that carry the full faith and credit of the state. You mentioned already briefly the general fund match requirement of Article 11G, Section 1.3. And I just, so if you look through 5516, every time, there's like a matrix, if you will, and every time you'll see an item listed under Article 11G, you'll also see at least a like amount or more in one of the other columns. I also want to mention that even though the, if you looked at the Constitution and read 11G, Section 1.3, you see there's a reference to a general fund match. But it has been the policy of the legislature for many years to not necessarily have that as what you might consider a straight general fund. For example, the community colleges, they have a 11G bond and then a match, but their bonds, but the match is not state general fund. It's typically a local community college district will sell their own bonds and use those funds as a match. But then there will be sections within Senate Bill 5516 that declare those funds to be part of the general fund, and they're kind of ran through a treasury account, if you will, to meet the requirements of the Constitution. And Senate Bill 5516, there are sections for each one of those that you give the specific authorization to do that and count that money as general fund. So that's how we meet the Constitution. It's through this bill and your authorization of those specific amounts. Also, sometimes lottery bonds will be used to match the 11G bonds. And I think even in the current biennium, COPs were used once. But Laura also mentioned 11J bonds, which are energy programs. So most of the items, I believe, that are in Senate Bill 5516, when you see the category heading for energy, those bonds, those loans, those energy loans are typically the source of that is the Department of Energy's 11J bond program. And those bonds typically are those energy loans typically are recover their costs through reduced energy prices. Next page is really probably the primary thing I'm here to talk about, the governor's recommended budget within debt capacity. Laura has outlined what the debt capacity is, and it's the top line of this. For those of you who don't need reading glasses for this, bear with me. I think I'll just kind of talk about what the debt capacity. Laura's already mentioned $789 million was what the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission recommended for 2007-09. The governor's budget includes $711 million in general fund-supported debt projects. So the governor actually, the governor's recommended budget actually spends $77 million less than the general fund capacity as outlined by the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. This spreadsheet lists the detail of the items that are included in the general fund supported debt in the governor's budget. Again, to point out to you, some of these numbers are going to be higher, so you won't necessarily see a match with Senate Bill 5516. For example, the item for the university system, various projects, $30 million. And if you looked at the detail in the bond in Senate Bill 5516, you'd see $11 million. That's because there's equipment projects that are also funded through COP. It has to be a long-lived asset to be funded through COP. So if it's, I think, veterinarian equipment or telecommunications, computer systems, the like, have been funded in the past using COPs for the university system. So on the lottery side of that spreadsheet, as Laura already mentioned, there's $443 million in the governor's recommended budget for lottery bond programs. And the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission allowed for up to $486 million. So again, the governor's budget is $42 million less than the maximum included in the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission's recommendations. And then at the bottom of the spreadsheet, just to make sure that there's no question on this, the number that you see for higher ed, university system, new construction, 11G, $91 million, that would be if you added up those projects in the column, in the matrix that starts out Senate Bill 5516. But there's also in Section 6 of Senate Bill 5516, there's a higher number. Items that were approved, if you will, in the current biennium, but perhaps it looked as though they may not be able to get funded in time. In the governor's budget, we have reauthorized some of those projects. So we don't need to list them again because they have a six-year limitation. They already have the six-year approval. But if the bonds weren't sold, then we need to reauthorize the bonds. So there'll be a higher number in one part of Senate Bill 5516 than the actual new projects authorized. All right. Moving on to the next page.
Can I ask a quick question about that? And pause and see if there's others. Is this an incorrect statement that my recollection is that the legislature generally has not rushed up to, and rush is maybe the wrong word, gone up to that maximum level? So you mentioned 711 out of the 789 possible, and the governor's budget is at 711. My recollection is generally we have not gone up to that 700. If previous sessions, it wouldn't be 700. By any means, it wouldn't be 789. It would be a different number. But we've generally stayed, and I think the chart suggests that we have, well below that level.
Senator Dicker, that is my understanding. I believe you're correct on that. And I think the reasons for that is the costs of the debt service that you'll have beyond that. But I don't believe that we've ever hit the target. But as Laura's mentioned in her testimony, sometimes the target moves. If revenues, and this is the part that I can't answer your question with certainty, if the revenue projections went down during the recession, then all of a sudden that debt capacity target would have dropped as well, and we'd already issued debt. But for the most part, I believe your statement is accurate. Go ahead.
If I may add, Senator Deckard, I believe at the last session there was a fairly hefty amount of debt that was authorized both for general fund and lottery. Mm-hmm. The reason that we didn't see that 3.7 move was because general fund revenues took off. But we would, if based on that close of session forecast, we'd have $1.4 billion less in general fund revenue.
Mm-hmm.
We would be closer to that 5% right now for general fund. I think we would have been well in the 4.5% territory.
Huh.
So we wouldn't have necessarily been right at the 5, but I think that we would have been a lot closer.
That's interesting. Because if that all holds, then we're looking at a very different Senate Bill 5516 at that point.
We would be coming for very small amounts of additional capacity if it wasn't that the general fund forecast grew. The base grew so much that it helped.
I guess, just to follow up on that point, you do see on the spreadsheet before I leave that page that there are lottery funds for new construction and for deferred maintenance and code safety. So
this is...
I think before in the testimony that you've heard or that's been given by higher ed before, we have a long-standing need to address deferred maintenance issues at the university system. And so the inability to issue debt for that in the past due to reduced revenue forecasts, I think the governor's budget is looking at addressing that at least partially with lottery funds in the current budget. So moving on to the next page. What are the capital needs on the horizon? Because when you're doing capital construction and bonding, you really need to look long-term. As I mentioned, these projects are six-year projects, but there's things that we know on the horizon that we're going to have to address, and we need to keep some capacity, if you will, in reserve for that purpose. With the Measure 11 and the current projections on the inmate populations, there is an expectation that we'll have to build another new major prison construction. And there's $10 million in the governor's budget for planning, and I think some initial pieces of that. But the actual costs beyond that, it's supposed to be just under $300 million. So in future biennia, we're looking at approximately $289 more that will be required in COPs for new construction costs. The state hospital to replace the aging state hospital here in Salem, or state hospitals perhaps might be a better way to describe that. There is $81 million, I believe, in the governor's budget for that this biennium in bonding capacity. We expect the need for another $370 million, or $81 million in project capacity. So that's going to eat up capacity in the future, and I think that's a longer term project, but that's the current estimate, I think almost $450 million in total. And then the wireless interoperability network, another big ticket item, there's about 220 plus in COPs in the current biennium, plus another $75 million in the Department of Transportation's budget for interoperability costs. total costs over the next two biennia, I believe, will increase that another $300 million. So I think there's $600 million in bonding is the current plan for the interoperability network. And then major DAS buildings that are planned, the mall building number 3, the Portland State Office building that was initially designed, the plan of that was to be able to build out on the ground floor and on the level, I guess, if you will. And so expansion of that is contemplated in the next two biennia. And then the Fish and Wildlife Department was moved to Salem. They're currently in leased facilities, but long-term we need to look at whether or not it's more fiscally prudent to put them in a state-owned facility. So those are big-ticket items that are known. Other items that aren't necessarily, if you will, I mean, I guess you'll have some discretion. I guess you have discretion with everything. But more discretion as to how much to fund certain items. The deferred maintenance of state institutions, I've already mentioned, that's a huge backlog. And as I said, it's been addressed to some extent in the current budget, but but not near to the level that's been identified. New construction and renovations at universities and community colleges, $87 million for community colleges in the current budget for new construction, $90 million in new construction, and just $11G for higher education. I think in the 2005-07 budget, there was $60 million. So there's an ongoing need for new construction as our university systems grow and need to be renovated.
Major Kenny, just a question on that. Should we give, and we're going to consider, I think, an amendment that gives some sort of prioritization as we look at this DAS bill, buildings and the wireless network, the assumption is there's no match. It would be all a state project at that point. Should we give some priority to projects that can at least, since we're going to, this at least gives you some sense of we're going to be limited in what we can do, should we give some priority to projects that can bring a match with them?
Senator Deckert, probably there's so many policy issues involved in this, federal mandates and the like. Obviously, as Laura said, for some programs, that is a way to make sure that real money is brought to the table by partners who also benefit from it. But I would not be in a position to say in a specific instance where match is appropriate given other requirements, other risks, if you will, for the state, such as the state hospital, for example. I think we pretty much have to go forward with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good question. It's a good policy issue for you all to wrestle with.
I think we're gonna. Good punt.
Major computer systems. I've identified the Judicial Information Network here. That's one that's in the governor's budget. But I think there's other ones. I think there's a major computer system for higher ed as well, and it's important for maintaining federal compliance. There's probably be others on the horizon. Grant loan programs, and sometimes these help local governments as they deal with their issues. I think the OECDD program is an example of that, where their bond bank is often used for local government infrastructure. Pollution control bonds, sometimes the private sector firm is gone, and it's to the good of the community to spend some state resources to clean that up. And then transportation infrastructure, obviously those aren't general fund or lottery supported necessarily, although Connect Oregon 2 for the non-transportation infrastructure, $100 million in the governor's budget for that, again, to take care of things like barge facilities, ports, rails, air terminals, the like. Laura's already mentioned seismic. There is money in the governor's budget for lottery bonds to help some seismic retrogrades at the university system, but nothing specifically for the seismic bond program. And just moving quickly to the next chart, it's actually a little bit outdated. It shows the estimated biennial debt service on 11G bonds. It doesn't include latest bond sales for higher ed. But I just put it there to kind of show once you sell bonds, you've committed a certain amount of resources for the next 30 years in the case of 11G bonds or 20 years for lottery bonds. So what you see that kind of stair-step effect is that probably the smallest little tail piece is what you issued last biennium, and that was 30 years out, and then the next one is two biennia, et cetera, moving backwards until you get to a stable area. Sometimes refunding changes that pattern a little bit, but it's pretty consistent. And then lastly, I'll conclude with other factors to consider in capital financing. You've already kind of talked about this a little bit, but our estimates are, with current interest rate assumptions that we're using for budget development, that for each $100 million in lottery bonds, each $100 million in lottery bond projects results in approximately $9 million reduction in available revenues, lottery revenues, for the next for other uses for the next 20 years. So obviously, lottery is used for K-12 education, economic development, you name it. So it is, as you have mentioned, it's a trade-off, it's a balance. Anytime you do the $100 million, you're going to lose $9 million a year. Lottery debt service has priority over other uses, excluding prizes and lottery program administration. So if something drastic would happen, as you've already discussed, bondholders are first in line, so to speak. So the parks, the Oregon and Education Endowment Fund, and all the other needs get in line behind bondholders. Laura mentioned that the lottery bonds carry the state's moral obligation pledge, so worst case scenario, you might even be throwing general fund at these things. And then 11G and 11F1, full faith and credit, state backed. I think we've talked about that. So, and then finally, all projects funded with tax exempt bonds are subject to IRS restrictions. So there's a lot of tax issues that I won't bore you with, but just suffice it to say that once you sell bonds for a project, you own those IRS restrictions for the life of the bond, so you can't turn around and, for example, sell a building that you've built with tax-exempt bonds unless you defease the bond. So there's other, you can't put more than 5% or 10% private use. So if you wanted to put like a store or something in a tax-exempt bond building, you'd run into some IRS issues there. You've got to build it within a certain period of time, and there's a fair amount of IRS regulations that have to be considered when you use tax-exempt bonds. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions. Mazen, is that what you were looking to cover? I could talk more about the bill if you'd like, but
we're going to get into that.
Okay.
We're going to get into – we really wanted y'all to help us. And we may ask you – I know you're incredibly busy back – at some point this week, just as we round out our work on this. But thank you very much for patience with us and at least the chair's dumb questions. We appreciate your help on this.
Thanks for your interest.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. So we will now hear, Laura mentioned the other side of the equation, which is helping the citizenry out and hopefully improving the economy so that we have revenue to pay off future bonds. We'll hear from community colleges today and higher education tomorrow. And Senator Monroe, you want to go up? We should call...
Silverman.
Okay, so we'll have Senator Monroe and Dr. Silverman and maybe Dr. Preston Pulliams from Portland Community College be our first panel. And I know there's a member of the House that we need to call.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, sorry for my voice. Senator Rod Monroe, District 24, and I come to you as a member of the Mount Hood Community College Board. Tell you a little story. Mount Hood Community College has a daycare facility, Head Start daycare facility, on its campus, has had for about 35 years. That facility was housed in 35 years ago, old modular buildings. And those old modular buildings have deteriorated over time in many ways. I've actually toured them carefully, and they're in really bad shape. In fact, the electrical system is such that if you turn on two switches at the same time, you blow the fuse. Our teachers are outstanding in this program, but the building is in very poor quality. Mount Hood Community College, like every community college that had a bond up in November, lost its bond. However, and so we've scaled back our capital needs to the highest priority, which is replacing our child care center. This will cost $5 million, and we have identified the $2.5 million match.
So we're looking for $2.5 million of capital construction, community college capital construction. Now, what does this Head Start facility provide us with? Not only good Head Start care for, and we will expand if this building is approved, from currently housing about 90 to up to 240 or more students that we'll be able to serve. But also, many of our single parent students at the community college could not get a higher education unless they have childcare. Childcare costs from $600 to $1,000 per month if you have to pay for it privately. So what we're talking about is the opportunity for hundreds of single parents to lift themselves up from minimum wage jobs or from welfare to a service level job that they can support their family on. At the same time, we're providing the outstanding boost for 3- and 4- and 5-year-old kids to give them every opportunity to succeed in school and in life. So it's a win-win. It meshes well with the governor's Head Start initiative. 40% of Head Start eligible children in the state of Oregon currently are unserved. The governor proposes to serve all of them. If we're going to do that, we're going to need facilities. And the facility on the Mountain Community College campus or on other college campuses is a win-win. You not only have the Head Start program, which is a major win, but also you provide an opportunity for the parents to get an education, to become a dental hygienist, or to become a nurse's assistant, or some other kind of a job other than flipping hamburgers at some fast food place. So, Mr. Chair, what I'm asking is that before we move 5516, that we add the Dash 1 amendments and then send it down to Ways and Means for appropriate funding. The board, the Mountain Community College Board, voted a month ago to make sure that the local match would be there. So that is secured. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions, or I want to introduce Dr. Silverman, the president of Mount Hood Community College.
Dr. Silverman. Are you going to talk about the Dash 1 amendments also, or?
Specifically the Mount Hood part of the Dash 1, Mr. Chair.
Perfect.
But I don't have too much more to say than he said, so if there's some questions, probably maybe we could answer the questions more effectively. Or I think the biggest point that I can say, Senator, is the whole issue here is the building is not going to stay for much longer. Might last a year, might last a year and a half, but it's going away. And we do need to take care of the 90 slots that we have right now and try to do the expansion. And the expansion to 240 would be a phenomenal resource to the whole area of East Metro.
Maybe we'll have Mr. Oh, we have to get your name. I'm sorry, I forget.
For the record, Robert Silverman, president of Mount Hood Community College.
Okay. So I have one question, but we'll let Dr. or Mr. Pullins, Preston Pullins, our president of Portland Community College, and then open up for questions if that's...
Well, first of all, good morning, Chair Deckard, and to the committee. Thank you for this opportunity just to take a couple minutes to talk about our proposed project. I'm Preston Pulliams, District President of Portland Community College. This project really complements what the college mission is, or our community college mission is across the state, and that is to connect what we're doing with the needs of the community. This particular project meets a critical need throughout our district, where we are being asked by local business leaders and industry to help provide a skilled workforce. In this particular proposal and project, we're particularly focusing on workforce development in the electronics industry and also increasing an allied health program. It also addresses another critical issue, and that deals with parking and transportation issues and needs of our students, which tend to be high priorities in our planning and also for our student and clients. The exciting feature about this project is that it is a creative, wonderful partnership between several key organizations in our community. Portland Community College, of course, TriMet, the Oregon Institute of Technology, and the Oregon Employment Division. It also will allow our college to increase services and programs in Washington County. This is part of our district that is one of our the fastest growing area, actually, especially for new immigrants in the bilingual community. The main rationale for this project and why it was really the foundation of its proposal is that PCC and the Oregon University System are in the process of selling a jointly owned facility at Northwest 185th and Northwest Walker Road called the Capital Center. This will necessitate providing new spaces for our programs that we currently offer at that site and hopefully some expansion. The specifics of this project, and Mr. Randy McCurran is here with me, my district vice president, has posters in terms of this. Why don't you put this up front just to give the panel an idea of what we're talking about. In this proposal, we're talking about adding at the Willow Creek project at 185th Northwest and Northwest 185th TriMet Transit Center in Hillsboro, square footage of about 100,000 square feet of office and classroom space. The projected cost of this project will be about $30 million. We're asking $7.5 million come from the state construction program fund, and the rest of the money will come from anticipated bond campaign for us throughout our district for 2008. Again, this will replace the Washington County Workforce Training Center that we currently house at our CAP Center. That program alone serves 7,000 citizens seeking seeking jobs in 2008. We placed approximately 2,000 of those individuals directly into current employment. We serve over 2,400 accredited students, about 400 FTEs, largely in technology. We serve about 50 SL, GED, computer literacy students there each month. Again, these clients are heavy transit users, typically need transportation access. In addition, this project, we're proposing in this site, the expansion of our medical assisting curriculum to the west side of our district and potential for bilingual medical assisting. Again, this project is a joint creative venture partnership. The project will be directly near the tracks of the TriMet Willow Creek Transit Station. It will be a green project, and it's strongly supported by the city of Hillsboro. Again, it's an attempt for us to answer some of our challenges for regional transportation and land use. Just one example as I close in terms of what happens in this area at the current CAP Center, and we would hope to expand. There's a group called Electronic Manufacturing Consortium, which is made up of a number of electronic industry and companies in the area. They have partnered with PCC since 2003. In a wonderful program where we've come together to recruit, train limited English-speaking citizens or residents in the district, again, to help supply a much-needed source of entry-level employees. The project is truly a joint venture. The company reps designed the course curriculum with us. They help interview the candidates. We provide the necessary classroom and training support, and this has provided a wonderful outcome. I'll just reach at a bottom line. 133 students enrolled in 7 classes, 130 graduated. Of those, 117 have been placed in jobs at a 90% placement rate. 109 graduates are still employed at a 93% retention rate. 86 of the graduates obtained jobs in the high-tech industry, with 71 hired by Electronics Manufacturing Consortium company. This is just an example of what's happening in that area. We hope to expand these type of workforce development efforts. What happens if this project does not take place? We would be really seriously challenged in terms of finding and relocating those services in Washington County, as you can understand, in terms of the buildup out there. We would be glad to entertain any questions at this time. Senator.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Chair, Senator Decker, I made a little error, I think, in the first statement you asked for. You asked for a comment about the amendment and we gave you a comment about our single project. Would you like me to clarify a little bit?
Well, I'll defer to the community colleges who might be orchestrating their testimony. Senator Monroe had mentioned that he was going to bring up an amendment to 5516, so at some point we should, and I will defer to whoever is chosen to talk about that amendment. If you'd like to, you're more than welcome.
Well, I was just going to comment that I thank the committee for considering this, and particularly Senator Monroe. It does reestablish the list as it was provided from the State Board of Education to the governor's office. The list got changed, and Mount Hood was one of the colleges that were left off the list. So we appreciate your consideration and acceptance of the amendment.
Thank you.
Senator Deckert, Chair Deckert, I had one thing I left out of my testimony I should have told you about. The federal government has changed the requirements on daycare in terms of the number of square footage and the way they measure square footage necessary for each student. And so even if we were able to keep our current facility open as it is, we would be able to serve, I think, about 15 or 20 fewer students under the new federal requirements, and that would mean a dozen or more single parents that would have to drop out of school. That's even if we could keep this old, dilapidated facility open.
Mm-hmm. Questions for this panel? Why should we? We historically have not bonded for community colleges, and you saw the previous presentation that shows some of the challenges the state's going to have, and our commitment to higher education bonding has been long, and why should we be taking on, it's not exactly new, but it's certainly relatively new commitments to community colleges?
Well, I'll start first, Mr. Chair, and the committee, in terms of my presence in the state for now 2.5 years, certainly serving as president of Portland Community College, but also working with the other presidents throughout the state. There is simply just a need to invest in construction throughout the state. Portland, we have been favored in terms of our own ability to raise to pass bond campaigns to provide construction dollars, but we continue to have needs. But I'm also very much concerned about the other institutions throughout the state. If we're going to be serious about the business of providing a skilled, trained workforce in the state to support the economy and quality of life, these facilities just simply have to be invested in to allow us to continue doing the job we're doing, but also expand our ability to produce a quality workforce.
That was an excellent question, and I have an answer. Since 2001, I believe higher ed tuitions have gone up about 60%, but community college tuitions have gone up over 85%. If I'm remembering the numbers, community college education is the education of last resort for tens of thousands of Oregon people who have no other opportunity to get a higher education. It's supposed to be the least expensive, and yet tuition increases have driven up the cost. It's very, very difficult when community colleges have to compete in that one election every 2 years with all of the K-12 districts and so on. Very, very difficult for them to pass a bond anywhere. As I said, all of the community college bonds that were up last November failed. And so looking to the state to help provide the 50% match for these absolutely essential capital projects, I think, is prudent and responsible. And to not include community colleges in some of this capital bonding, but to only do higher ed, I think would be imprudent.
All I can say is that the value of community colleges depend a certain amount on the facilities we have to teach. As our time goes on, these facilities are aging. People are not taking responsibility of local commitment. Obviously, our bonds don't pass. So right now, you have a system which is in jeopardy. Our child care center may be a very small one, and it's much greater jeopardy. But as time goes on, and the facilities continue to erode, we will threaten quality of education for community college students, citizens of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Majority Leader Dave Hunt, Representative Vicky Berger, and we have a few other people. We're down to three left to testify. We'll just Liz Goulard from Chemeketa. I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name, Miss. Oh, good.
How do you do, members of the committee? For the record, State Representative Vicky Berger from Salem. I will be brief. I know I am speaking to the choir, but let me take a 100,000-foot level and talk for a minute about community colleges and what they mean to our state. I've been an observer since they really started forming in the 60s out of the junior college system. And they were at that time a local government, sort of an option, a small sort of something between high school that might not be college. But I think they grew because they are a critical resource for people. And as our economy has grown and as our workforce has changed, it's become more and more apparent not everybody can go to college, but nobody can be employable right out of high school. It's just a fact. So somewhere we need to have a system that meets this critical need. And it's getting bigger and bigger as we realize that there's tons of jobs in the new economy that don't require a college degree. And there's a lot that do, but a college degree becomes more and more expensive. So the community colleges have filled this huge niche for training people affordably and in their local communities. This is a statewide resource now. It's no longer just a local issue. But for the people that go and get trained and learn at community college, they have to be close because they all work. You can't leave your job, go down to the University of Oregon, take 4 years or 2 years or training or up to OSHU. Just about all community college students are also employed in their community. This is a huge resource. We also know that the jobs are changing. The training requirements are changing, and that's where you come in and this proposal comes in. You can't build for past jobs. You have to be anticipating and preparing for the next round of jobs. A lot of them are in healthcare. I know you've heard lots of testimony about the requirements of facilities in healthcare. There's just growth in general need for buildings in the community. It's time for the state to take a lead here. We've left it to the local community as the system is being built, and it's going to overwhelm most local communities. But the needs are still there. The job needs are still there. The economic development that comes from training people to actually work and participate in our totally income-based, income tax-based state economy is still there. So in the meantime, I think it's time for the state to step up and be part of the solution and help these colleges build around jobs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. I think I'm very consistent with what Representative Berger just said. It's really not a new investment that we're looking at here. It's really just a long overdue investment. I mean, if you look back in the 70s, we actually did step up as a state and make a significant investment in community colleges. It's just been the absence of that during much of during my lifetime, Mr. Chair, that where the state has really just been has not stepped up to the plate to make the kind of investment that really has multiple benefits. It has a really unique benefit of having an economic impact in every community across the state. Obviously, you've got a short-term construction job benefit, but much more importantly, you've got a long-term benefit in kind of creating the jobs for the future workforce that we really do need. And it's not just going to be targeted, you know, in one place in Portland or just in one place in Eugene. By honoring the package that these community colleges have come up with, we've got a real opportunity to stimulate today's economy and then to help create a workforce for tomorrow throughout the state. The amendment that you have before you is also consistent with a bill that Representative Berger and I introduced in the House Bill 3345, which re-adds these exact same projects to really honor the process that all 17 colleges, frankly, very miraculously, went through in the interim to come together behind one common prioritized list where they set aside their differences and set aside their second and third and fourth tier priorities to really come together and say these, based on a workforce criteria, are the top priorities for investment. And that they committed in each of these cases to come up with a 50% match if the state would come up with the first 50%. And so you'll see on the Dash 1 amendments, as it's probably already been talked about, the addition of the campus in McMinnville, the Klamath project, the Mount Hood project, and then the alteration of the amount for Lynn Benton. That we think that very much honors the very thoughtful process that the 17 colleges went through. And really leaves us in a great position to make an investment that is long overdue, that's going to leverage all those local additional dollars, and we're going to take care of that double majority problem this session so we can help them, give them a tool to help leverage those dollars as well. But that will leverage all those additional dollars and really leverage a workforce that's going to be important for feeding the income tax dependent revenue system that Representative Berger mentioned. So we very much encourage your adoption of the Dash 1 amendments and then the passage of the bill moving forward.
Great. Thank you for, I know y'all have worked really hard on this bill and have heard you in different venues speaking to these projects.
Thank you.
Any questions for, they probably have to get to to the floor.
No questions. Thank you.
Ms. Goulard.
Good morning. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. I'm Liz Goulard. I'm Vice President and Chief Academic Officer of Chemeketa Community College, and I'm here to speak to the construction priorities for Chemeketa that are contained both on the governor's recommended list and also in the Dash 1 amendments. Among the promises addressed in our mission statement is that of providing access to any and all who choose to enroll in college. And it's really the open door policy at the core of community college values that drives much of what we're asking you for this legislative session, whether it is the ask for the $529 million in the Community College Support Fund to reverse some of the disinvestment, which has whittled away at our state support, whether it's the ask for additional access for students through the shared responsibility model, or whether it's the ask for the space and infrastructure support for our facilities to support our instructional mission. They're all critical. Might start by just helping to answer a question that you raised previously about why invest in community colleges and when we do have the ability to raise local revenue. Return on investment studies that we've done, and I know every other community college has done the same, would show that every dollar that the state invests in a community college is returned five times over in terms of additional tax revenues. You have more educated citizenry. They're able to
An operating study? That study was done on an operational investment or capital two or the overall?
It is taking a look at the effect that we have on our regional economy in terms of the students that have flowed through our doors and what they are bringing to the annual economy in terms of wages and benefits, in terms of reduced state burden on incarceration and welfare, social welfare costs and so forth. The other point I would make is that the partner money that the state provides for our capital construction will allow us to leverage other sources of revenue, and we're pretty good at partnerships and leveraging, and you'll hear a lot of those examples today as you listen to others. So let me just talk really briefly about the two priorities on our list. First is the Classroom and Health Sciences Center, and there are two things driving the need for this facility. First is the condition of temporary facilities on the Salem campus. You heard Dr. Silverman talk about the Child Care Center. We have a number of modular buildings on the Salem campus that are in similar condition. We've had to tear two of those down this summer. They were simply unfit for student habitation, and we have some critical space issues. We have a number of other modulars remaining. They came to us used in the 1970s. They're very expensive to heat and cool and spendy to maintain as well. And they're beyond their useful life, and they're deteriorating in terms of walls, floors, ceilings, roofs, and so forth. So we're really at a crisis point with regard to having adequate classroom space, considering the temporary and soon to be gone nature of the modulars. The other demand driving the need for this facility is for healthcare workers of all types in Oregon. The Employment Department documents a 24.8% increase in healthcare occupations between 04 and 14. This translates to an additional demand for technologists and technicians, close to 9,500 jobs, and healthcare support occupation demands of 18,000 jobs. So you're going to hear and see on the list a large number of healthcare facilities, and there's a reason for that. They are coordinated in terms of the types of training we would provide. Those figures I mentioned don't include vacancy rates. So the health services industry employs over 100,000 people, and unfilled positions represent a loss to the economy of $42 million annually. So there's a significant job that we can do in providing additional health care workers. We have a good record of high-quality healthcare programming, registered nursing, EMT, providing dental assisting, medical assisting, and healthcare services management. What this facility will allow us to do is to expand. We have no additional space for adding any additional programs. We are in partnership with the Oregon Institute of Technology, and this facility would allow the two entities to bring a dental hygiene program to the Mid-Willamette Valley, as well as provide space for our new pharmacy technician and pharmacology program. We're investigating the possibility of a psychiatric technician, very needed in the Salem area given the needs of the state for providing support for a mentally ill. And those things, in addition to the classroom space and the ability to expand science labs, which are at capacity, we can't add additional science classes, those would all be provided in this facility. The project is a 60,000 square foot facility, and the total project budget is $18 million, so we'd be looking for a 50% that we would match with a bond measure in November of 2008. Briefly, the McMinnville campus was also addressed in the Dash 1 amendments. We're currently operating with two modular buildings on the west side of McMinnville, purchased used in the 1970s. We operate about 14,000 square feet in that facility, insufficient for the needs of meeting the population in Yamhill County. We're the only community college site in Yamhill County. It's the fourth fastest growing county in Oregon. Population grew by almost 40% between 1990 and 2006, and access to higher education there is a critical issue. Over half of the county is population is low income. Community college education will really help those individuals get ahead. The existing site and its eight classrooms have supported enrollment that's grown more than 250% in the 20 years we've been operating it. Mm-hmm. We have to rent facilities all over the region to accommodate our current needs. We do own 14.7 acres at a former outlet mall in McMinnville, located directly across from Willamette Valley Medical Center. We'd like to bring a major facility to that site to create a footprint for what we see eventually being a much more comprehensive campus. And that 40,000 square foot facility would allow us to tremendously increase our academic and student services to Yamhill County. That project is anticipated to be $12.5 million, and we're asking again for the 50%. We would match it in a November, anticipated election November 2008. Questions?
Thank you very much. Questions?
I have to go to the floor.
I have to go to the floor. Thank you. And that we have members leaving for the Senate floor. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. John McArdle, someone we know well here on double majority issues. John Turner and Frank, I believe, Toda. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Senator. Thank you. Let me take about 2.5 minutes and cover a couple of things. I'm John McArdle. I'm the Director of Development at Lynn Benton Community College. That's my day job. We're asking you, as part of this whole package, for $3.75 million. We need a science facility because we have an increased need for folks with that have science background, whether it's high tech, whether it's healthcare, high tech manufacturing. We currently are serving approximately 5,000 folks a year through our science facilities. We have 48 labs able to provide chemistry and 48 labs in biology, and that's serving 5,000 students. We're turning away people. We're turning away 3,700 students a year, and we just don't have a place for them to sit. When it comes time for registration, in the first few minutes, sometimes as little as 7 or 8 minutes from time registration begins, the science classes are full. We need a place to put these folks. What we're asking for is for you folks to provide the matching funds, which will allow for the renovation of our current facility, and also to build a new 20,000 square foot science facility. So with your matching funds, the college will put in its certificate of participation for about $2.75 million of that match, and then we've raised over $1 million in private money to put towards this. And when I talk about the private money, which I spend a lot of time doing, we have contributions that are coming in from our local industry and from local businesses, and that's the kind of gifts. Many of them are the largest gifts that I've ever made. So we have a real need in our area. We have significant participation. The senior college leadership is back in Washington, D.C., hitting the feds up to equip those facilities. And let me talk just a little bit. As you've heard from my colleagues, you know, we need facilities. You also hear in other committees, you hear about scholarships and financial aid. Well, you know, you got to have both. We need facilities, and I think it was most poignantly put, we had a congressional member on campus not long ago, and we ran the list of veterans that were currently taking classes. I was able to show the congressman a list of 252 names. I couldn't hand it to him because of FERPA, but could show him 252 names of veterans from the Iraq War that are on campus. We don't have a place for them to sit down. They can't get in to science classes. There's not a place for them to sit. We need space. We need access. We need a place for them to go. They deserve to be able to sit in a science class. And so that's what we're asking you folks for, is the 3.75 for our particular project and the dollars and cents that will help the other community colleges to do what they do to help economic development in the state and to serve the citizens. I stand ready for any of your questions.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Deckard. I'm John Turner. I'm the president of Blue Mountain Community College, and I've come here to discuss the Eastern Oregon University Center. That's a partnership between the City of Hermiston and Blue Mountain Community College and Eastern Oregon University, and there's a one-page glossy here that you should have in front of you. First, I want to thank Governor Kulongoski for supporting this important initiative in his budget. This is precisely the type of strong partnership that the governor's asked us to pursue in delivering post-secondary education and training to the citizens of Oregon. We believe that this university center, which I want to emphasize, it's a single building.
My understanding on this, the match is there on this project, or you
not yet closer raised to your $2 million, match. And we're confident that we can raise the rest of it. That $2 million comes from both private donations, federal appropriations, and value of land services, that sort of thing, from the City of Hermiston. Mm-hmm. And the City of Hermiston has already voiced its interest in pursuing a local bond initiative, and we really haven't started a capital campaign for this yet. But there's very strong regional support for this. When I say the City of Hermiston, this is really a regional project that looks at that whole western Umatilla County, Morrow County area that's the fastest growing area of eastern Oregon. It's the largest school district in northeast Oregon. It's going to be the largest city in northeast Oregon. It's got two major transportation corridors that come together there. There's a port. Mm-hmm. There's talk of a racetrack in Boardman. This area has been steadily growing now for 30 years as our programs, BMCC programs in Hermiston, represent almost 20% of the reimbursable FTE that we have for the entire six counties that we represent out there.
So, and I hate to get you off. So
sure.
The legislature, and I know you want to talk about, and I'm somewhat familiar with this project, if the decision was to lower the amount, and obviously no decision has even been made in that respect, are projects within the process the community colleges use, like yours, that have more of the private or the match in place, are they moved towards the top of the line in terms of, or is we will reach that decision when we have to, and we have not begun those discussions in terms of prioritization of the different projects?
I think the only way I can answer that question, Senator Deckard, is to tell you that the priority that was given to the State Board of Education by the community colleges is the priority that we've agreed to amongst ourselves. I feel very uncomfortable speculating at this point in time as to what priority this project should have. I would have to support the prioritization that the community colleges put forward.
Sure. And so match was maybe part of that discussion of who's got 40% of their match in place, 0%, 100%, that was part of, but not the ultimate determiner of the list of as we got it.
That's correct. Okay. It was just one of many things. We had community colleges that you've already heard about, dilapidated facilities. You've heard of 2 years ago we talked about community colleges that didn't even have a campus or were working out of condemned buildings or strip malls and that sort of thing. And so 2 years ago, those projects had priority. Mm-hmm. Now what we're trying to do is look to the future. We see the middle schools of this whole region. They're just busting at the seams because population growth is there at that age group. If we don't do this now, we'll be turning around 5 years from now asking ourselves why we didn't, because the reality of it is we're so close to the Tri-Cities that these students will vote with their feet. They will say, hey, distance is, it's just as far to the science labs in Pendleton, Oregon as it is across the river to Columbia Basin College, for example, and they'll go there instead, and we will not serve our community. They'll pay more money. They'll commute farther. There's a need out there right now. This building will have lab sciences in it, just like you heard previously, to support both AAOT degrees and allied health programs, and it will have normal classrooms so Eastern Oregon University can offer baccalaureate degrees and master's degree programs. It'll be a very versatile facility. I think I've kind of hit a lot of the issues that I really was planning to talk about here in the rest of my testimony. So I think that this and the one-page glossy that talks about it.
Exciting project.
Look at the population growth in that area. It will be the largest area in Eastern Oregon in just a couple of years. And I think this is a prudent measure of meeting the needs of our students in just a couple of years.
Yeah, no, it's success. And you've done a lot of work to bring it to the point it's at today.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Batting cleanup.
Senator Deckard, for the record, my name is Frank Toda. I'm president of Columbia Gorge Community College. We represent approximately 10,000 square miles, an area that would be the size of the state of Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Delaware combined. As I was listening to testimony today about the need for workforce training, about the need for healthcare training, I couldn't help but say to myself that fits the need that we have in our community to build a workforce training center. That is the item that is on the list, to build a workforce training center in collaboration with the National Guard, OUS, the Mid-Columbia Council of Governments, the Oregon Employment Department, and we also have signed on the K-12 organizations as part of the group that would actually occupy this building and use it for workforce training. Gave you a lot of materials up there just to represent how all this would fit together. You have a document called Building a Career, and this is really the roadmap that we would use to pull all those people together. I won't talk to that today in the interest of time, but it is the package that we would use that would integrate this in terms of a focused mission for workforce training. In terms of patting ourselves on the back a little bit, you have another document up there. It's a one-pager. It's called An Investment in the Future of America. As also talked to earlier today, we have discovered in reality the return on investment factor that happens from the state funds being put into the community. In our community college, we're looking at about a $4.30 return for every dollar invested. And we've seen that happen because In the last 3 years, we went from the area with the highest unemployment in a nation to a point today where we can say that we are actually in the mix in terms of unemployment. That would not have happened were it not an investment, were there not investments from the state. Today, we currently are a national model for rural health care. Last week, I was back in Washington, D.C. I got to meet with the Secretary of Labor, Secretary Elaine Chao, and she commended us for becoming a model that actually is being used across the United States in terms of health care training. That is what an investment from the state of Oregon has done for our community. Today, we find ourselves to be the only wind energy training program on the West Coast. There are three wind energy training programs in the United States, and currently we are the only one on the West Coast. And so we have this huge need for job training.
How many students are in your wind industry?
Currently there are 24 enrolled. We had 85 on the wait list. The problem is facilities. We have gone from 6 months ago, no program, to today with a program. We essentially took pieces of our ART building and converted it into a wind energy hydraulics lab. It's called being agile. But at some point in time, we need to have a place to gather, and so a workforce training building would give us that capability. The need is there. I didn't start with the need because it's kind of a downer. We closed two aluminum plants, as you well know, in the region, and put 1,000 people on unemployment. It's an area that is also depressed because of agriculture. It is not the place to be these days. Thousands and thousands of acres of wheat farms, not always producing because of the changing climate. And of course, cherry business has been a on again, off again activity. So we have a lot of people that are interested in training into new job skills. The thing that made the healthcare training model such a success is the fact that we were actually taking people off the pot line from the aluminum plant and putting them through the new RN program. And oh, by the way, 2 weeks ago, I gave testimony here about the fact that we just received our 8-year certification for the newest RN program in the state. So again, all of this has happened because of an investment in our community, and so it's a long way of saying a thank you to you all, and also encourage you to continue in that investment in capital infrastructure. It is truly a need in our communities.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. And again, this committee is mostly focused, the predominant focus of this committee, although it is helpful to hear about the projects, very helpful to hear. We will hear more in the Ways and Means subcommittee about every project. We are really looking at that first question of appropriate debt levels, both on the lottery and on the general fund side. But it's very helpful to know the projects intimately that are out there.
Thank you.
We'll do higher ed tomorrow. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5516 and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 152 and start this discussion up again tomorrow morning at 8:45. We are adjourned.